How's it going, listeners? This is your opinion writer here at the Arizona Daily Star, Edward Celaya. We're here on the Point Being podcast. Sarah's out for today. I'm joined by two of my favorite co-workers here. First, our cartoonist, Mr. David Fitzsimmons. David, how are you today?
I'm pretty good. Hey, readers, write your names across my heart.
And, of course, we have our government reporter, Mr. Joe Ferguson. Joe, how are you?
I'm well.
That is good to hear. Good to hear. All right, so we're going to jump into a few local topics first today, starting first with our kind of analysis of the Prop 205 election and how it
dumb question,
really
dumb
went
question,
down.
Dumb question.
Go ahead.
Dumb question. How do props get their numbers?
Joe, that's one for you.
Why is it like Prop 1?
Well, you don't want to use the same number over and over again. You don't want to vote on Prop 101 over and over and over again. So they switch them up a little bit.
So it's just really, it's kind of an arbitrary.
I'm sure that there is a, you know, 2 pages of text somewhere at the city level that explains in gross detail how to do it. But let's not put our listeners to sleep so early in the podcast.
That's a good question, though.
I don't know. I think I got a column idea. Prop 205, yes!
Prop 205, if you kind of are living under a rock or you're not a native Tucsonan, it was up for election, or excuse me, up for passage this last election, and it went down in flames. What was it, about 70-30, right, Joe?
Roughly, yeah.
Now, we released a story last week kind of indicating it was a heat map of where it performed best and where it really went down most.
Yeah.
Can you kind of explain what we found out of that, Joe?
We found a small portion of Tucson, what our columnist Tim likes to call the
streetcar corridor, right?
Yeah, the streetcar corridor, where it passed and everywhere else it failed by some amount. So it was a very small portion of Tucson that did 50% or better to back this Sanctuary City initiative, where it just failed everywhere else.
Gotcha.
Dave, Barrio Volvo? I think that's my
Barrio
old neighborhood.
Volvo.
Well, that's right. That's my old head.
So, Dave, what do you think it... I mean, I think we thought it was going to be fairly close, right? Or if it was going to be go down, it wasn't going to be this big.
Yeah. I'm hoping that it is a segment of the population that agreed with our wisdom that, yes, you know, it's well-intentioned, but there's unexpected consequences. Coupled with, no doubt, the knee-jerk righties who just would not want to vote for anything that had a whiff of compassion towards immigrants. So I think it's a blend of those two elements together. But I was a little bit taken aback at how the map pretty much mirrored our prophecies.
Yeah. The one area in Tucson that really surprised me, though, was the South Tucson, or the southern part of Tucson, not South Tucson proper.
Yeah.
I thought there might be a precinct or two in there that would, that's the Democratic stronghold of the city. I thought for sure there'd be one or two precincts that went for 205 there. But, Joe, you're kind of nodding your head no on that.
Well, I'm
one.
Just saying, you know, one out of three people actually turned up to submit a ballot.
Good
so,
point.
You know, 2/3 of the people sat on their hands and decided not to vote. So it's really hard to tell. I mean, we saw a strong Republican turnout despite the fact there wasn't a Republican torchbearer. And, you know, Fitz got a great analysis of it, but I got to tell you, man, they backed up Brinks trucks to this election and just spent money on all sorts of mediums to make sure that they gave out the most scariest version of the message they could on Prop 205.
And that's definitely something that I've heard from the Tucson Families Free and Together supporters. I believe it was, what was the name of the group behind it? The
People's Defense Initiative.
Yeah. I was following a little bit of what they were saying on Facebook post-election. And they still are of the mind that they got a lot of their ideas out there and that the city actually needs to work with them in basically kind of implementing the things they were asking to implement through this process. How would they go about doing some of the things that they were hoping to do through the initiative now that it's failed.
Well, they can make some changes to the general orders for Tucson Police Department where some of the core changes are there. So they don't have a lot of control over what Border Patrol is going to do, but they can, you know, really make sure that TPD is doing what the supporters wanted. And those changes can be done fairly quietly and, you know, maybe, just maybe, stay off the radar of the Arizona legislature, which, you know, has already threatened to punish the city of Tucson if they change a letter in the general orders.
That's true.
You know, typically I'm the sort of person who likes to bark, "Bring it on!" But in this instance, no, don't bring it on.
Yeah, that would, especially in this case, I think it just gets us more unintended consequences,
Let's make sure our readers understand what those unintended consequences look like. It looked like, you know, one-third of the city's general fund. If the city had lost that money, and it's unclear whether it would, we were talking about an entire department shutting down. Your parks department would be one guy with, you know, a weed whacker, and that's about it. It really wouldn't be, you know, most city departments. It would be just fire and police, and that's about it. It would have gutted the ability for the city of Tucson to perform the most basic of services.
I think then that we kind of dodged a bullet with 205, or at least that's kind of the perception of a lot of people, especially folks who campaigned against this. You talked about the Brinks truck being backed up to kind of, I think it was almost a 10-to-1 margin of dollars spent. Is that pretty common for a proposition, especially a local city one like that?
We haven't seen it in this kind of way. So propositions generally are put out by the county or the city, and they propose it, and then there's a small group of people that come out and say, yeah, I support this, and then maybe there's an anti-group, but we don't see six figures being dumped into an initiative. And, you know, this time around, it really was a who's who of Tucson putting money in there. And, you know, even more so, there were people in Phoenix that were getting involved in this. So it was a really expensive race. We're not even sure how much, but the last time I checked, it was $330,000. And I got to imagine it's far more than that when we get those reports.
Wow.
I'm going to put forth a premise, and okay. I want your view of this.
Surely.
You know, my thought that of the vote is this, that Tucsonans voted against it not because there's an overwhelming anti-immigrant sentiment in the community, but because folks who were mostly, Tucson being mostly a welcoming community, just felt that this proposition would be self-destructive to the ends of this community, which is to be a welcoming community. So I can't help but think, no matter the outcome of that vote, that Tucson remains a welcoming community.
If I kind of looked a little bit into the history of propositions passing here,
yeah,
there, other than the red light camera one, has there been a citizen initiative that's passed since then? And that was 8-9 years ago, right?
Yeah, I mean, there haven't been a lot of citizen initiatives lately that have passed. Obviously, we see the Give the City Council a Raise initiative that pops up every 2 years and then inevitably fails. But, you know, citizen initiatives are not easy to put on the ballot. They require a lot of work. And so what we often see are things that are referred to the ballot by the council or the Pima County Board of Supervisors.
Got it. I think that that fact in itself already kind of limits the appeal of what Prop 205 could be. So because if they already aren't able to get Democratic, usually fairly sympathetic council members to even bring this up or to bring this as an initiative that way, then they're already, I mean, you're already kind of fighting against the powers that be. So I guess what I'm really saying is when I really look at this now, it's kind of inevitable that it probably wasn't going to get too much support.
Yeah. Yeah.
But yeah, such is life.
Such is
life. I did want to touch on one other thing with the local elections. I think that Ed Ackerley actually overperformed what we thought he was going to show up. I didn't see him winning that many precincts, even on the east side, where the Republicans are a little stronger. Go ahead, Joe.
I think you underestimated the guy. I mean, he used to be a Democrat as of January. And I think that, you know, 15 years doing elections, I got to tell you that, you know, when you have two people essentially on the ballot, sorry, Mike Cease, we really have people.
Now, wait, tell us who Mike Cease is.
He's the Green Party candidate.
Okay.
But when you have, you know, two major candidates on the ballot, generally speaking, you know, it's pretty easy for the people to vote against the Democrat or the incumbent or the front runner and say, no, I can't back that person, him or her. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's easy to get 25-30% of the vote, you know, just naturally, just because people want, when they have a choice, don't want to back person A or B.
Yeah.
I think Rahina's base of power is on the west side and downtown. And so traditionally we've seen that Republicans, you know, there's a stronghold on the east side. I remind our listeners that, you know, Nikki Lee lost her ward in this election. You know, just because, you know, she won the election didn't mean she won her ward.
Didn't Paul Cunningham also lose his ward as well?
No, Paul did all right. He got about 3,000 more votes than his Republican contender. But this is the first time. 4 years ago, he lost his ward. So, you know, he flipped it this time around. But often the time, you know, Ward 2 and Ward 4, they actually go to Republicans.
What does that tell you about our system, huh?
It's an interesting system, yeah, for sure. That is... It's in line for its own podcast one of these days as well.
I only did one cartoon, really, about Ed Ackerley.
Yeah.
I spelled his name wrong. I got to open my email. The subject line is, hi. And then the note says, spelling of Ackerley, L-E-Y, sign, Dr. Ed. Sorry, dude. Man.
That's really my fault. I'm supposed to catch these sort of things in your...
Yeah. Well, the ghost of Walter Cronkite thumped me in my sleep. So,
Dr. Ackerley was a fan of your artwork, though. He decided to take it a little bit further.
He did, didn't
and
he
rented himself a nice old steamroller just to use as a prop for a press conference. I was there for it. And so you got a shout out, my friend. So he didn't harbor any grudges.
I was glad for it. And I saw Congressman Grijalva and Mayor-elect Romero last Friday, and they didn't bear any grudges either. Sneers.
Sneers.
Mock sneers. So we just eyed each other. Hey, 4 more years of you.
So,
I've got news for you guys. It's not 4.
Oh, really? Well, why don't we go ahead and reveal it here for listeners? What is that news, Joe?
8.
No, it looks like it's going to be 5.
Oh, because all right, keep going.
Yeah, so we did not get 75% of the total numbers that we got for 2018 voting. So the state legislature has their thumb on the city of Tucson and will push them to move back their elections to an even number year.
Oh!
So then now there could be a better voter turnout, just because usually those even number years, you're going to have a presidential election or some sort of federal election, right?
Well, that could be the case, but, you know, there's such a thing as the undervote, where you just can't manage to get to the bottom of that ballot.
Those down ballot. I gotcha.
And honestly, you know, if you have a 2022 election, you've got brand new congressional districts, you're voting for governor, you're voting for God only knows how many different races. It's going to be quite something to decide who's who on what issues. So it really would be a down ballot kind of thing. But, you know, it'd be Mayor Rahina in 2024.
Wow. What a revelation.
I'll start making the appointments for the candidates now, boss.
And that's crazy. So in 2022...
There is a legal fight that will happen, but generally speaking, the law is pretty clear.
All right. Huh. Well, 5 years then.
I'm just boggled thinking selfishly about the amount of labor for those of us here in the media. When you have those many, that many candidates, those many issues, who knows how many propositions. Wow.
Fitz, I'm already writing about the 2020 campaign in tomorrow's political notebook. So it's already started, buddy.
What a perfect segue.
Joe,
second topic, which is the 2020 local elections.
No way.
And it's never, obviously, psychic. As Joe just alluded to, it is never too early to get ready for this. It is our Super Bowl coming up as journalists.
Wow.
Presidential election year.
That's right, because this is 2019, and you're talking 2020. That's next year.
A month and a half away.
Gentlemen, there are 19 candidates running for Congress in Southern Arizona between three seats. And we're not done.
So why don't we, in the interest of limiting, you know, we only have so much time here. Why don't we kind of figure out which is going to be the most competitive of those three races?
I think,
in your opinion, Jim.
I think that CD2 has always shown to be the most competitive among the three. Mm-hmm. It's built to be a competitive district just by the boundaries and who is where on it. It's a very competitive race. Republicans, Democrats, both can win it. Incumbent Ann Kirkpatrick is certainly running for another term, but she has two Democratic challengers, if I remember correctly. Mm-hmm. And I think there are six different Republicans who are vying to gather attention. One right now is giving away a semi-automatic rifle along
very
with
nice.
A couple other things if you just sign up for his newsletter. So it's going to be a very long race. I think it's going to be a very high publicized race as Republicans really make a push to focus on competitive districts to take back the House.
High caliber race.
Yeah, and now if I remember right, that district's congressional district 2 is pretty fairly split between registered Democrats, Republicans, and Independents, right?
Correct.
It's pretty much a third each.
Yeah.
That should be interesting.
Yeah, and you got all them there rancher people yes. down in that valley of Sonoyta area. Right?
Well, we also got all those Republicans who live on the east side of Tucson that voted for Ed Ackerley.
Them too.
It's not just Cochise County you got to think about.
So we actually had Congresswoman Kirkpatrick in here last week. If you want to listen to our special edition of the Point Being podcast, that's also available on Tucson.com. We asked her a little bit about this upcoming election. Number one, about how Republicans had been fundraising. There was an email that basically said, like, we need to target Ms. Kirkpatrick so that we can get ammunition to take her out. That was obviously not something you want to do in the district where Gabby Giffords was shot in a mass shooting here.
Yeah.
What do you think the approach is going to be for Republicans in this district? They obviously can't go too far right.
The guy that did that particular stunt is the guy that's giving away the semi-automatic rifle. So it's certainly no whole bars in terms of how you want to campaign. He is running to the right. He's backing Trump. He's calling Ann Kirkpatrick, you know, essentially a gun grabber where, you know, I can remember back in my Flagstaff days where Ann Kirkpatrick would campaign, you know, talking about her A-plus record with the NRA.
Right.
So it's a complicated thing, but we're certainly going to see a large clash in terms of politics, in terms of Republicans being hypercritical of Kirkpatrick and her support for almost anything from abortion to gun control to, of course, impeachment.
I'm curious about you're probably already looking at the primaries themselves as well. Do you have any sense of how the primary will shake out among the Republicans?
It's just too early to tell. There's a lobbyist by the name of Shay Stouts who used to represent the University of Arizona.
And who has a guest opinion in today's Daily Star.
So he's a newcomer to the race. Some of the other people have been running either for a while or ran back in 2018. So it'll be interesting to see how his message resonates here in Pima County as well as in Cochise County. So right now I think that Brandon Martin, who came in second last time around to Leah Marquez Peterson, probably has some name recognition and has the ability to raise money compared to some of the other candidates.
Now you said that right now Ms. Kirkpatrick has two challengers potentially in the Democratic Party. Are they going to be coming from her left, or are they more centrist than she is?
One's a self-described activist, so I assume that's a left. But it's hard to tell right now. We really haven't heard a lot of platform ideas or arguments there. And so, you know, I've known Ann for 15 years, and so her political leanings have changed over time. So I remember, you know, when she lost up in Flagstaff to Gosar, you know, she had, you know, a kind of a moderate kind of blue Dem kind of message. And we'll see right now kind of where she goes in 2020.
I think the other accusation against her that's kind of followed her wherever she's gone is that she's kind of a carpetbagger. Was that the same case up there in Flagstaff? I know out
here. No, I mean, in Flagstaff, her roots were pretty well established. You know, I know her ex-husband. She had a law office in Flagstaff in downtown. I remember interviewing her in her old law offices. I mean, she has strong roots in Flagstaff. It's just after she lost her congressional seat, she got married. Her husband lives in Phoenix. So, you know, it's kind of an argument about carpetbagging that was important in 2018, but she's represented Tucson for 2 years now, almost. And so it's a bit different now.
Gotcha.
That's going to be such an interesting race in the with Trump as the backdrop to all of it.
Totally. I think that that's like a kind of microcosm of America, that little congressional district.
Do you suspect he'll visit Arizona on behalf of McSally?
Well, I think that McSally and others are absolutely vying for that right now. We've already had Mike Pence come out, so I think it's inevitable that we're going to see Mr. Trump in Arizona. Whether he comes down below the Gila is another question entirely.
I was just going to say, because I think that the big, or at least kind of the knock against McSally's candidacy against Sinema in 2018 was that she ran too close to the president. And that that hurt her with suburban voters, particularly suburban women up in the East Valley of Phoenix. So I guess my question would be, do you think that McSally would really want to run that kind of campaign where she's tied to the president again?
She is. We can just see it in terms of impeachment and what she said about that recently. So I think that she has, you know, hitched her wagon to the Trump administration for better or for worse. And I don't see any signs of that really changing in terms of that. Her press spokesperson just recently left her office to go work for Mike Pence. I think that, you know, there are some very strong ties there. And I think that she's always been proud of the president's support. I don't see that changing, but impeachment is a nasty little kind of trick, and we'll see if people defect, you know, depending on where this goes.
What do you think, David?
I'm a cartoonist. I'm just so happy about the present moment. You know, we're talking about McSally. All I can think of is how challenging it is to draw Mr. Giffords. I'll call him Mr. Giffords. Mark Kelly, you know, his space shuttle versus the little warthog. It's going to be difficult in terms of scaling in the cartoon, but that'll be a happy image to use. I think the only time that she really varied with the president, didn't she take a contrary position on, you know, on Syria and with the Kurds? And
so did everybody for 15 minutes, didn't they?
Well, there's been a couple different things. She's also made some comments when that tape came out that were somewhat critical of the president, if I recall correctly. So she's done some criticism of the president, but, you know, generally speaking, in terms of Southern Arizona, I think that the loud chorus of our readers tell us that it's, you know, just too close to the president in a lot of ways. But we'll see. I've seen Republicans who say that she's not supportive of the president enough.
I have, too. That's why I'm interested to see where this goes with her.
Will she and Kelly debate?
Oh, certainly. There will be no way that the voters of Arizona will all allow them to just have a proxy war over TV and through mailers. They'll absolutely have to debate. And, you know, it's this political reporter's hope that there are a lot of debates.
Yeah.
Woo. That'll be a good time.
Yeah.
All right. So another thing that was kind of happening in the news this week had to do with the Northwestern student newspaper. And if you're not familiar with it, basically what happened was Jeff Sessions came to speak at Northwestern about a week and a half ago. There was a protest of students that the paper covered. And those protesters had a problem with that. the editorial that we are going to be talking about in question basically recanted some of the reporting that the newspaper did, said that they were wrong to reach out to student protesters by phone, by text. They said that was that they were sorry for violating their privacy, and then they took down some photos of some of the protesters at the event because ostensibly they were felt threatened by their photos being online. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
What a cluster of public, issues.
Public sort of event, public protest.
Right. Now, I've always assumed that if I'm going to, which I haven't done since being an employee, but if I'm going to protest publicly, hey, too bad, dude. You're in public.
Yeah, that's kind of the rules. That's kind of how it works.
Well, right.
But there are other rules in place, too. We've seen people who wear...
the voice of reason.
We've seen people who wear masks. Yeah. We've seen people who wear bandanas and, you know, the November of November masks, you know, the guy Fox.
Yeah, Guy masks. Fox. Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
You know, so there are people out there that have that concern, and I think that's a tacit acknowledgement that they understand that they are in public,
exactly,
that they are in a place where there are reporters, and, you know, especially for my photographer brethren, it's hard to sneak up on somebody with a camera nowadays. So those things are not just, you know, something that's tiny. When you point one of those things, you know it's being pointed at you.
More concerning for me even than the kind of retractions and the reaction of the staff, the editorial staff there at the paper, was just kind of the expectation that people have now that, oh, if I complain or if I reach out and say that I'm offended that you used my image or something that I said, that somehow that garners, oh, well, we'll take that down. That's not how I envision journalism working. That's not how, even if I was not in this field, would envision a story involving me having to go about.
Perhaps in the real world. My question is, though, did this take place at a learning institution?
It did.
And was that part of the reasoning by the administration that these are fetal journalists, or these are infants we're dealing with that require special coddling?
That. Eddie and I talked a little bit about that a couple days ago. Listeners might not know this just by my voice, but I got a late start in journalism in a lot of respects, and so I absolutely was a father and, you know, a full-fledged adult when I graduated college. And I think that to just write off student journalists as being somehow less than adults is just kind of demeaning right out the gate.
Exactly. And just to kind of echo your point, Joe, I just came into this job 6 months ago right from the Daily Wildcat, so right from student media. And I think the big takeaway I take from this is while I think it's admirable on some level that the students said that they were trying to be a little bit more empathetic to communities that are not as well served, this is not at all how you serve underserved communities. You go about by telling the truth. I think the most glaring line to me in this editorial was that we know that our jobs as journalists is, you know, to go out there and tell about what's going on, we still make sure that we have a good relationship, basically, with communities that have been marginalized. And while those are two very beautiful sentiments, I think that the most important is to the truth. The biggest, you know, our biggest job are the people that we answer to are not necessarily people that are in activism, you know, that are in positions of power or positions of activists.
We answer to history.
Exactly. And in retracting this, these folks, they've done more damage to journalism.
And it also suggests in a metaphysical, cosmological way that, hey, they weren't there. Did that event happen? I don't know.
I just want to throw back just for a moment to say that I really appreciate the fact that, you know, the reporters there went above and beyond.
Definitely.
It is super easy just to get a quote and to walk away. But these people took the time after the event was over and used the resources they had to find students, to contact them, to text message them, to get more of the story, to get more than just a quip or that, to ask why they were there, to ask what they were, what their concerns were. I mean, they went further. They dug deeper than a lot of people do when we talk about these kind of campaign stops. And so, you know, I think that what the Northwestern staff did in terms of the reporters was really good journalism.
I agree. I agree. I just think that the editorial kind of walking it all back kind of does it a disservice.
I agree.
Well, this calls to mind another issue maybe for next year's podcast. I'm sure you've heard or read stories about various newspapers doing an online review and subtracting or taking back stories that they believe might be harmful to the individual in the story. You know, when an individual wants to disappear from the internet, perhaps the story had an error in it or, yeah.
That is an interesting, the right to be forgotten.
The right to be forgotten, yeah.
All right. Well, gentlemen, thank you so much for joining me here this week.
We didn't forget you.
We did not.
Yeah. Although you might have a right to be forgotten. We didn't forget you,
Eddie.
I
see what you were getting. I was like, what are you getting at here? You got me.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you so much for listening into the Point Being podcast. My name is Edward Celaya. I guess I should let you know that the views and kind of expressions here do not necessarily reflect the how does it go again?
The views
don't necessarily reflect those of Lee Enterprises
or the Daily Star
or the Daily Star or it's just us.
The Daily Star and Lee Enterprises.
All right, I'll get that in post. But anyways, thank you so much for listening in to us. This has been Edward Celaya. Thank you so very much.
Adios.
Vaya con Dios.